more conceptual questions during the talk and ask them.
But if there's something really big or some really serious problem with what I have to say, maybe wait till the end, because I'll give about 5 minutes for questions at the end too. Okay? So I guess I should also just say before I get started that thank you for everyone for coming out, because it's good to see the grad students are getting more support from people, and especially the faculty and the postdocs that are here. So thanks a lot. Okay, so today I have two main things that I want to accomplish with my talk. The first thing is that I want to try to educate you, hopefully, about 2+1 gravity, what it is, and its relation to Chern-Simons theory in particular, and tell you about some things that I think are really beautiful about that relationship. The second thing that I want to try to do that I might not have as much success in doing is to try to excite you about 2+1 gravity. So basically to try to convince you that studying 2+1 gravity, even though it's not the real physical theory of the universe, is still interesting and may lead to some really nice results. Okay? So hopefully I can do that too. Alright. And since those are my two main themes, my motivation slide is probably one of the more important slides in my talk, which is why it's the first slide. And so I'll tell you why I think we should study 2+1 gravity in the first place. So the very first thing is that it's a nice toy model for 3+1. So why do I say that? Well, because it's gravity, it's the same action, just in one less dimension, it should have all the same symmetry properties. So it's diffeomorphism invariant. There's a local Poincaré symmetry, or local Lorentz symmetry in the theory. So we expect to have this 2+1 theory to have a lot of the same symmetry properties. Another thing is that, okay, the theory might have similar mathematical structure too. So in 3+1 gravity, you may not know this, but if you do, you can write it in terms of an Ashtekar connection, which is valued in SO3. So this is a complex connection. So there's two SO3 connections. Basically, the reason why you can do it is because of the isometry between the Lorentz group, SO3-1, and two copies of SU2. So what's kind of interesting is that in 2+1 gravity, you also have a connection, and the connection is valued in SO2-1. So you might expect that there are some mathematical similarities between the theory, even though they're more complex. So I could make that more precise, but I'm not really going to stress that in my talk. So but the other thing is that in 2+1, we do have consistent quantization schemes. So we can actually do stuff. And for example, we can see how time, classical space-time, emerges from a quantum background. We can sort of see how we can resolve the problem of time, but in an easier framework. So 2+1 has a lot of the same features of 3+1, but in a context where we can actually do something, we can say something about the theory. Right. So I should point out one major difference, which is that in 2+1 gravity, there are no local degrees of freedom. So there are no gravitons in 2+1. And that's a pretty big difference. But anyway, so so there are differences, and that's one. Okay, so with having said this, I'm not gonna say anything more about it for the rest of my talk. Okay, so these things are good, they're important, but the things that I wanna focus on are the next points. And that is, that there's an interesting link, which I'm going to talk about, between Chern-Simons theory and knot theory. So I should say the rest of this slide is meant to make you begging for more, okay? So if you have questions after the slide, that's okay, because I want you to be interested and excited and confused, not confused, but wanting to know more, okay? So I'm going to talk about a connection between gravity and Chern-Simons. And there's also a beautiful relationship between Chern-Simons and knot theory. So basically, by thinking about 2 plus 1 gravity, we can learn something about knot theory, which is lives just which is something, a problem of pure mathematics. So I'm going to talk, because I'm going to mention it later, I want to talk a little bit about knot theory. So before this connection was discovered, there was no existing three-dimensional algorithm for, yeah? I'll get to that, yeah. Okay. So, okay, let me do it over here. So for those of you who don't know what knot theory is, the basic idea behind it is to try to classify different knots, which are essentially embeddings of a circle in three dimensions, based on different topological properties. So for example, I can write down just a normal circle, and this is called an unknot, okay? Or I could draw something that looks like this. And what this is supposed to be is it's supposed to be a two-dimensional projection of a three-dimensional real physical knot that I could draw. So, I could have this knot here floating, and this would be the shadow of the knot on the blackboard. And so the point is that no amount of smooth deforming of this knot here or this circle will give me this knot. So they're topologically different. And the goal of knot theory is to be able to identify properties that will separate this thing from this guy. So for example, what you could do is you could label these crossings like this. And then you could write out this knot in some sort of code where you start from a point here and you go through some orientation, and then the code would look like start from here, go under 1, then go over 2, then go under 3, then over 1, under 2, over 3. So the point is, what I'm describing to you right now is an algorithm for writing down this knot. And then what you can do is suppose you have more complicated knots. So some really weird thing. You could do the same thing. You could write out a code. And then you can work with the code and apply various operations to these numbers and see whether or not you can reduce the code of this guy to the code of this guy or the code of the circle or whatever. And so in knot theory, people design algorithms to try to do this. But what's interesting is that this algorithm requires that I take a two-dimensional projection of a three-dimensional knot, right? So even though this object is three-dimensional, I can write its properties on a two-dimensional blackboard. And then I can prove that that the algorithm does not depend on the particular projection that I picked, right? So this was a puzzle to knot theorists for a long time because they couldn't understand why all the algorithms that they had required you taking this projection into two dimensions. And they always seemed to work, but nobody had a purely three-dimensional description, so that's what I mean, okay? Sorry, my mouth is drying up. All right. Yes. I don't know. Compact what? I have no idea. I don't know. That'd be interesting to think about. Yeah. Okay. Well, okay. But then generalized knot theory would just be line circles embedded in higher dimensions. Okay. Fair enough. I don't know anything about this. Yeah.
That's having two-dimensional surfaces in four dimensions. It's not very easy, but there is a small issue for that.
Okay, so you might be able to generalize this, but that has to do with what I'm going to talk about. So the point that I wanted to make is that these are two-dimensional descriptions, essentially, but they're actually three-dimensional objects. So it's kind of a surprise that the analysis that you do doesn't depend on the projection. Okay. That's the main point here. And then there's something that seems completely unrelated, and it's so unrelated that I'm going to draw out on this chalkboard. And that is the holographic hypothesis. And this is a general hypothesis, which I'm going to go into details later. But what it says is that there is a link between gravity or quantum gravity in n dimensions and field theories that live in n minus 1 dimensions, which is why it's called a holographic hypothesis, because it's as if our world, our quantum gravity theory, is a hologram. All right, so this would be a surface that is one less dimension than, so that's why it would be a hologram. And what's interesting is in 2 plus 1 gravity, you see that this thing, this holographic hypothesis that you can come to from basic arguments in semi-classical gravity. And this knot theory, this problem of pure mathematics, are actually connected. Okay. And I'll talk about that in my talk. So that's going to be the main point of my talk to illustrate that. And then the last thing that I want to do, and here is where I'm
going to hopefully, so this is going to be the last part of my talk, the last couple slides. I'm going to try to talk about what we can learn about the connection between, well, what I think we might be able to learn in terms of the connection between string theory and loop quantum gravity just by studying 2 plus 1. So in particular, we have this ADS CFT in string theory. But we don't have an analogous thing in loop quantum gravity yet. But in principle, we could do a lot more in loop quantum gravity than we could do in string theory, because in loop quantum gravity, in principle, especially in 2 plus 1 dimensions, we have access, in principle, to the full theory. Whereas in string theory, we don't have access to the full non-perturbative theory. Yes? Alex, yes, I'll get to that. Okay. So again, this slide is to get you begging for more. All right? Okay, good, good. Good. And we actually had a nice talk earlier this morning on ADS-CFT. And the last thing is, this is the really speculative thing. Maybe we might be able to find non-perturbative strings in loop quantum gravity. And I'm really glad that Florian is here, because he sort of helped motivate me to think that might be possible. And my claim is that the ADS-CFT might be a very nice tool to use to actually prove that if we do find non-perturbative strings in loop quantum gravity, they're not going to look anything like string theory, because they're going to be non-perturbative and background independent. So how do we prove that they're actually related to the strings of string theory? My claim is that the ADS-CFT could be a tool to do that. So that's the end of the talk, and hopefully I can get you sufficiently excited and confused. Yeah. Well, strings, as in strings. Yes. Yeah. Sure. Anyways, I'll get to that. I'll explain it more. I haven't gone into any detail at all. Okay. But I will. All right. Good. Good. All right. So, the meat of my talk. Okay, so this is the part that hopefully I'll be more successful at convincing you of. So on my way to, I said that I was going to try to link this holographic principle and these ideas behind knot theory. So the first step in doing that is to try to convince you that there's a link between general relativity and Chern-Simons theory. So, first of all, So first of all, I need to tell you what 2 plus 1 general relativity actually is, okay? So you can construct this theory by looking at, the general way to do 2 plus 1 or general relativity in general is to have a metric and a connection, right? And that's the way you learn it in undergrad. That's the way you might learn it in a first year grad course. But there's actually a very nice way of looking at general relativity, and that is through a tetrad, what people call a tetrad, and a spin connection. So the tetrad is a Minkowski vector it's a Minkowski vector valued one form. So it doesn't roll very nicely off the tongue, but all that it means is that you have a field, E, that in a particular basis has space-time coordinates mu. So in three dimensions, mu goes from 0 to 2. And it also has a Minkowski index, A. So it's a vector that lives in Minkowski space, but Minkowski space, but it also has values in space-time. Okay. Then you also have a spin connection. And the spin connection is an SO21 valued one form in 2 plus 1. So again, here you have a spin connection, and it has a space-time index that makes it a one form. But it also has two internal indices that represent the space of SO21. So for example, it'll have one value for each of the generators of SO21. But the amazing thing in 2 plus 1 is that the tetrad can be written as in a way that makes it look a lot like an SO21 valued one form. Because SO21 has three generators, and the Minkowski index has three components. So if you just rewrite it like this, mathematically, it's the same as a connection. So this allows you to write general relativity in terms of two gauge fields. Okay? But what's even more interesting, the even nicer trick, is that in 2 plus 1, the gauge invariance of these guys. So if you treat this guy as a gauge field now, and him as a gauge field, they transform in this way under a gauge parameter G. But the really interesting thing is that you can rewrite this gauge transformation with suitable combinations and suitable identifications as a diffeomorphism. So here, the diffeomorphism is the same as the gauge transformation. But the caveat is that you need to apply the classical equations of motion. So on shell, there's no difference between a diffeomorphism and a gauge invariance in this theory. They're the same thing. And that's really the nice trick, is that you can write general relativity as a gauge theory, and it has all the same gauge invariances you'd expect. So diffeomorphism invariance, local Lorentz invariance, which comes from this guy. Okay. Any questions? It looks like, yeah? Sorry. So, okay, I see what you mean. So this is, and that's what I mean, it's essentially the same thing. I mean, generally you think of this in terms of a vector in Minkowski space. So for example, in 3 plus 1, it would be a vector in Minkowski space. So it would have four indices. And then the spin connection would be valued in SO31, which has six generators. So there, you can't make the same connection. You can't write the tetrad as an actual gauge field. Right, but in three dimensions you can, and that's the beauty of it. But you can only do it in three dimensions, so it's a trick. And then this other trick is quite nice too, right? But it relies on the fact that you're using the equations of motion. And the equations of motion in 2 plus 1 gravity are trivial. They say that the curvature is constant. So really, it's this feature of 2 plus 1 gravity where the classical equations of motion are trivial that allows you to do all of this interesting stuff. All right? It allows you to write it as a gauge theory. So, okay, there we go. That's what I said. All right. Now, let me write down the action, because, again, some of you might be familiar with this form of the action, and some of you might not. So I'll just give this to you in more detail. So this tetrad, the action you're probably used to is something that looks like the Riemann curvature tensor minus the cosmological constant times a volume element. So here I'm just calling negative 1 over L squared, the cosmological constant. Okay. So this, on the surface, looks nothing like this. But I'll tell you what identifications to make. So the metric G alpha beta is equal to E alpha A E beta B times eta AB. So this is just the eta, the metric of Minkowski space. All right? Now, you can see, in order to construct this, I need to actually take the inverse of the tetrad, which means that E has to be invertible. In order to construct the metric, I need to be able to invert the tetrad, which means that you can only construct a metric if the determinant of E is not equal to 0. All right? So this is an important point, that I can only construct a metric when this is satisfied. And I'll come back to that. So first of all, you make this identification. And then the next thing to do is find a relationship between the curvature and these new variables. And I can just tell you what that is. You can write it like this, mu rho sigma is equal, times the tetrad is equal to F A B rho sigma E B nu. All right. So now that I've told you how these things are related, and then F is just given by this formula in terms of the spin connection. So F is a two form. It's an SO2-1 value of two form. Okay? And then now that you have these guys, you can just sort of plug in, work things out. And what you find is that the Einstein-Hilbert action is just equivalent to this. All right? Any questions? No? OK. So that's the action. That's the form of the action I'm going to work with. All right? So now I'm going to think about a different theory, which is the Chern-Simons theory. And this action might not be familiar to you either. So I'm going to make a couple comments about this, because I think it's kind of interesting. The Chern-Simons integral, or action, comes about by considering what type of theory could we write in four dimensions that looks similar to the Yang-Mills theory, but doesn't contain a metric. And then we're naturally led to an action in three dimensions. And I'll show you how. So the Yang-Mills action in four dimensions. So imagine we have a four-dimensional manifold sigma, and sigma has a boundary. So sigma has a boundary M. Okay. And then the Yang-Mills action just looks like the trace of F wedge Hodge star F. And you can see that the Hodge star in order to be able to take that operation, you need to have a derivative. You need to have a metric. So this thing is not manifestly diffeomorphism invariant for that reason. But if I consider now the closest thing to this that doesn't contain a metric and is diffeomorphism invariant, I get something that looks like the trace of F wedge F. You just take out the hard star. Now, the interesting thing is that this four form is exact. So you can write it as a total derivative of some, well, you can write it as a total derivative. And if you work it out, okay, I'm not going to here, you find that it's just the total derivative of A wedge dA plus 2/3 A cubed. And now by Stokes' theorem, this is just integral over M times the trace of A wedge A, A wedge dA plus 2/3 A cubed. So this is what I call the Chern-Simons action. All right? So it's an action in three dimensions, and it has this form. So that's how it comes about. All right. That's wrong. Now the interesting part. So this action is just something that arises naturally by trying to find a diffeomorphism invariant theory that looks like Yang-Mills in four dimensions. And you can actually show, if you just plug it in, that the Chern-Simons action evaluated with these gauge fields actually gives you this action exactly, plus some boundary terms. Okay? So gravity in 2 plus 1 dimensions is not only a gauge theory, but it's just the sum of two Chern-Simons theories that that are just very well understood and very well known. Okay? So if we can understand Chern-Simons theory, and if we can quantize Chern-Simons theory, we should be able to do the same thing for the GR action. Now, I should say that it's Chern-Simons theory with SO2-1 value connections. Okay. All right. So that's the next step now, is how do we understand Chern-Simons theory as a possible to quantize? All right? Okay. All right. Now, it is possible to quantize Chern-Simons theory, and it was done in the late 80s by Witten. And it turns out that there's a very interesting connection between Chern-Simons theory and knot theory. So I want to say a few words about that, because this is really beautiful to me. And it explains this this connection here. Okay, so I mentioned knot theory, so I'm going to go back and tell you a little bit more about what you can do in knot theory. So I need bigger chalk. So the most general situation in knot theory is you don't have one knot, you have a whole bunch of knots. And the knots can be linked together. So, for example, you could have just a circle like this with some orientation, and then another circle here. And this is a link. In general, you can have many more links, and you can have more complicated knots. This could be some complicated knot, okay? But for now, I'm just going to consider this. And then the idea is to try to find invariants, topological invariants, to describe these links. An example of a topological invariant that you can imagine trying to construct is called the linking number. And so for the linking number, you take all the left-handed crossings. OK, I think I need my notes for this. So a left-handed crossing looks like this. And it has a value of negative a half. And then all the right-handed crossings. And they have a value plus a half. So if I change this orientation like this, then what I find is that I add these, both of these crossings are right-handed, and I find that the linking number for this link is just equal to plus one. If I change the orientation, then these, both of these links change their orientation also, and the linking number turns into minus one. Okay? So you can imagine for more complicated knots, more complicated links, you could have linking numbers that it can be computed in this way. And you can show that these are true invariants. All right? So in general, there are much more complicated. So this is an example of what people call a link invariant. So it's an invariant you can get from links. And there are more general types. So an example is the Jones polynomial. And I don't want to go into the details, but it's an example of a type of link that you can get in knot theory. Okay? So why did I mention that? That's because there's a connection that Witten found between... So what Witten actually did was he constructed a Hamiltonian and did a canonical quantization of Chern-Simons theory. And then once you do that, he found that there's a relationship between the link invariant and the expectation value of the Wilson loop for the Chern-Simons potentials. So these are the Wilson loops for these paths defined by the particular links. So again, we had a talk earlier today about Wilson loops, but I just want to review what a Wilson loop is. For those of you who haven't seen it before. So, well, this is the definition. If you have a particular path gamma, so it could be one of these guys, then what you do is you integrate over the path gamma the gauge field. So let me just describe the general situation. You have a manifold, and then you have some paths in the manifold. That could be linked and knotted, and there can be I of them. And then there are also gauge fields, Chern-Simons gauge fields, that live in the manifold. And what you're going to do is, to calculate the Wilson line, you just take... you integrate over this particular path the value of the gauge field, and then you take the exponential of that. And you also need to add a path ordering to make sure that this thing is well-defined. Okay? But the important feature is that this thing depends on the path, and it depends on the potential, but it also has a dependence on the representation that you take. So you could trace in the fundamental representation, and you'll get a certain answer. Or you can trace in a different representation, and you'll get something else. Okay. So that's what you do. And then if you want to find these linking numbers, oh, sorry, I should mention the features of the Wilson lines. So the interesting features of these Ws, the Wilson loops, is that they're gauge invariant. That's the first thing. So that's nice. But another thing, which is even more interesting, is that there's no metric that was used in this definition. So A is just a one form, and you're integrating over a line. So you don't need the metric here, which makes this thing Diffeo invariant. And so you now have a property of this path that doesn't depend on, so that will be the same for all equivalence classes of paths. So the idea is that hopefully, because of these properties, this Wilson loop will tell you something about the properties, the intrinsic properties of this path gamma. And so that's just very hand-wavingly what I'm trying to say. But when you work out all the details, you find out that, in fact, that's true. But the expectation values of these guys, so when you take the product of all the Wilson loops, this lambda shouldn't be here, sorry. It was a different symbol before. It's supposed to be a dot. But if you take the product of all the Wilson loops of all the paths, and then you do the path integral over all of them, you find something that is topological, or that is an invariant property of these links. Okay? And then picking different representations to do the trace over will give you different link invariants. So, for example, if your gauge group is SON and the representation R is the fundamental representation, then the link invariant that you get is the Jones polynomial. So if you take different representations of higher dimensional representations of SON, then you'll get more generalized type of link invariants. And so they could be generalizations of the Jones polynomial. And that was the really interesting that Witten found, was that you can generalize this notion of link invariants and get all kinds of really interesting things. And they all come from Trin-Simons theory. Okay? So I think that's really quite beautiful. And I just should make a comment that the measure used to do this path integral is ill-defined unless you add a framing to the loops. So it's still an open question about how to actually compute these things for non-compact gauge groups and all kinds of stuff. So there's still interesting stuff to be done to actually do real computations. Any questions or objections to that?
No. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let me move on a bit.
So now we'll go back to the point that I made earlier about the fact that all algorithms used. Oh. Yeah, so all algorithms used to describe knot theory are inherently two-dimensional at 5 minutes. 15 minutes, okay. Thank God. Okay. So, what was I saying? Right. Two-dimensional, okay. Now we actually have a Trin-Simons theory, so we have an intrinsically three-dimensional representation of knot theory. But what else is interesting? Maybe because of the fact that 2D knot theory can be represented as a two-dimensional algorithm, maybe you might be willing to believe that there's a two-dimensional representation of Trin-Simons theory. In fact, that's true too, because in the same paper where Witten did this, he showed that there is an isometry between the Hilbert spaces of Trin-Simons theory in 2+1 and conformal field theories in 1+1 dimensions. And so the canonical picture that people usually have is if this is your 3-manifold and this is some cut, sigma, the actual quantization that Witten did was you look close to here, you have a manifold that looks like sigma cross R. And then you can write out a Hamiltonian. But what's interesting is that the theory that lives here, so is isometric to the full Hilbert space of the whole theory. So there's an isometry between a 1+1 conformal field theory and a full 3-dimensional Trin-Simons theory. And I just wrote this here to make that plausibly possible, but you can actually work this out, okay? And then I want to say that when M has a boundary, this is even more interesting because your CFT can just live on the boundary of the space-time. And then you have something that looks a lot like ADS-C of T, right? Okay. So just to summarize, I showed that quantum gravity can be written as the sum of two Trin-Simons theories. But then there's an isometry between the quantizations of the Chern-Simons theory and conformal field theories. So really, this implies that there's a connection between gravity and 1 plus 1 conformal field theories. Do we expect this? Is this a surprise, or is this something that we expected all along? And the answer is no. There were conjectures that gravity should be represented by a theory of lower dimension a long time ago, in the 70s, based on just very simple arguments. So the argument goes like this. Imagine you have some region of space-time that's maximally dense and has maximum entropy. And then you add a very tiny little bit of energy into this, and the whole thing collapses into a black hole. Well, at the end of the day, you know the entropy of the black hole is going to be related to the area divided by the Planck length squared. So if you believe that the second law of thermodynamics holds, then you need to know that the initial entropy is less than the final entropy. And so the initial entropy of this thing has to be less than a quarter of the Planck area squared. But this is really strange when you think of entropy in terms of information. Because if you want to think of entropy in terms of information, then you want to think that really what this, you can interpret this formula as saying that there is a bit of information that lives on a Planck length squared of area. So this thing is just a grid of ones and zeros that live on the surface. But over here, what that means is that the maximum amount of information that you can have can be contained just on the surface of the space-time. So what it means is that you expect to have a lot less degrees of freedom than you normally would, because of so essentially there's a lot less quantum states than you'd expect, because a lot of the energy states of the system will collapse into black holes because they have too much energy. So the statement is that you can describe the system just by information that lives on the boundary. And that's a statement of the holographic principle. And that is essentially what you do find in 2 plus 1 dimensions. OK? So, yes? Yes. And 93, 94, yeah. So, OK, yeah. I mean, it wasn't. Well, there were some arguments in the 70s that talked just about the entropy you should expect, so the Bekenstein conjecture. But you're right. The more precise statement came after. So yeah, historically, that's not how it happened. But yeah.
I'm not aware of the holographic, like,
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, the history is not. Yeah, and I know that because the years just don't match up. 93, 94. But for the purposes of my talk, the idea is that you. Okay. So I should have phrased it differently. I should say that you get this thing that looks like holographic principles, but you can actually get reason your way through this from things that are not even related to Chern-Simons theory at all. Just these basic, simple arguments about entropy, black hole entropy. Yes.
In case when you're just a black hole regime.
Yeah.
Do you need to investigate whether the system statement holds in general before you?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. But I mean, so there are some things you can imagine adding matter in a way that doesn't change the entropy or something. But yeah, I mean, this is just a very heuristic argument. But what's interesting is just and that's why it's a hypothesis, not a proven theorem or something. But again, the only point of throwing out these slides is to show that you expect something like this from quantum gravity. In fact, you expect it in any dimension. But in particular, this holds in three dimensions, and we have an exact statement of that here. Okay? Right, yeah. You can probably, I'm sure that you can refine something more than what I just put to you right now.
Okay. So the things that I'm thinking about, but this might not be related, which is that in sort of quantum information, you have the problem that people talk a lot about the area scaling of entanglement, which is entropy of a system.
I think we're going to talk about that tomorrow. Awesome.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm going to talk a bit about that. You get it. It's a very different way of looking at this.
Yeah.
Maybe you should let him finish in
the end. How much time do I have?
Sorry.
We can go a bit over, but yeah.
I think you're
not that now.
Oh, exactly. Okay.
Theoretically, we have 5 more minutes.
Okay. Yeah. So there's still a couple things I want to say. And that's just that a particular case that's interesting is when you have the negative cosmological constant. Because here, the solutions to the swim gravity are entities in space. And you also get black holes. And the black holes are just in this inner space with various identifications made. So you identify certain points in this inner space and you get these BTC solutions. So even though you have constant curvature in 2% of energy, you still have black holes. And these black holes have Benson Hawking entropy and they Hawking radiate. And you can study the properties of those black holes by looking at least in the semi-classical.
You can study them by looking at the conformal field theory. So let me just say, yeah. So in 2+1, the conformal field theory that's related. So now that space-time has a boundary, because we have an anti-de Sitter space, so there's a boundary at infinity. And there's a conformal field theory that lives on the boundary. And in particular, the boundary theory for 2+1 gravity is this West-Zimino-Witten theory. So if you study this in the Euclidean signature, and you look at what happens with these black hole solutions in the semi-classical limit, you find that you can actually reproduce the formula by counting microstates. You can reproduce the formula for the Beckenstein-Hawking radiation. So that's really interesting. All right. But I wanted to make just a comment that so you get this conformal field theory by requiring the boundary to be cage invariant and have classical solutions. So, I don't really want to get into that because I don't have that much time. So the last thing I want to mention before my last two slides is spin foam quantization. Because you can also do these quantizations. I described one type of quantization, which is Trin-Simons. But there are also other ones that I don't know as much about. But Laurent certainly does. And what's interesting, the comment that I want to make is that, okay, there are no local degrees of freedom here, so the theory is topological. And that allows you to do a trick, which is to look at discrete manifolds. So it's okay in 2+1 gravity to discretize the manifold as long as the discretization that you have is the same topology as the manifold you want to study. So it's okay to do a discretization without losing structure. In 3+1, where you have local degrees of freedom, you can't do that. You have to take the discrete some limit where the discreteness goes to zero or something. But here you can. And so this trick is used in Panzano Reggi models to help quantize gravity. But the comment that I want to make is that the trick can be used essentially for the same reasons why you can use this Trin-Simons trick. Because the local equations of motion are trivial. And so In the transimons theory, you could write it as a gauge theory. Here, you can use this discretization. But I want to make a comment that this theory is not well studied for the case where the cosmological constant is negative. And to know how to apply the boundary conditions and get black holes and stuff. So one of the more interesting cases, at least in my mind, where you can actually do things that look like ADS-CFT because you have a boundary, and you also have black holes. Right now, it's not totally understood how to study that in the spin film picture. So that might be something worth exploring. Okay, and then, like I said, you can develop ADS-CFT. I think it would be really interesting to see how to do ADS-CFT using the loop quantum gravity techniques. And one of the reasons is because ADS-CFT has been so rich in string theory and fruitful that it would be nice to do loop quantum gravity too. So, okay. So this is my last slide. So this is where I'm going to try to mention part three and hopefully convince you of my sort of wild statements. Okay, so the first thing that I would say would be an interesting problem is to actually complete the spin film picture and study the case where the cosmological constant is negative. And the main reason is that the Chern-Simons theory is not well defined for non-compact gauge groups. So the West-Amino-Witten theory, we can study it in certain limits, which is how people recovered the Bekenstein-Hockey formula for the BTZ black holes. But in general, nobody knows how to solve it. But the spin foam picture might be better suited to studying that. So the spin foam picture might have more to say. Now, here's something else. Is a recent paper by Witten where he conjectures a monster theory. So if you remember, at the very beginning, I mentioned that there's only a connection between the metric formulation and the gauge theory formulation when when the tetrad's invertible, right? So Witten claims that when we're studying gravity, really we want to be studying this action. And this gauge theory is not going to reproduce all the same features of this guy because it has different features. So his claim is that the best way to understand gravity in 2 plus 1 is to actually define it through the conformal field theory that it's dual to. That's in the case where the cosmological constant is negative. So he's taking sort of a backwards approach and saying, I want to define gravity by the CFT that it's dual to. So that's interesting because...
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of a weird logic. So his claim is that you can learn something from the gauge theory, but not everything. And so, the gauge theory that I described is related to West-Amino-Witten theory. But his claim is that West-Amino theory is not
the right conformal field theory to use. It should be something else. And that theory will be dual to this. That's his conjecture. And the conformal field theory that he picks is one that has monster symmetry. For amongst many reasons, the monster group is interesting, but also because it holomorphically factorizes. So there are various reasons why he picks that theory, but he likes it because. So there could be, so the point is, of writing this down, is that it's a conjecture. It's a pretty wild statement, but I think we can do better. Yes.
Yes, yeah. And so if the conjecture is true, it would be pretty, very interesting. If it's not true, then that would be interesting too. But I think that we can say more about this than what he's done, because we have a nice spin-film quantization. And so we can make exact statements rather than conjectures. Something else I want to mention is that in Chern-Simons, there's this framing that helps you define the path integral. And it's interesting, in spin foams, there's also a framing. And the reason, essentially, for both of these framings is to regularize the quantum theory. At this point, I hear a lot of I've talked to string theorists who've said, or I've talked to a lot of people, I should say, that have said that string theory and quantum gravity are very different approaches to the same problem. Because string theory is background dependent, and they postulate strings from the very beginning. And the strings help regularize the theory. So
you hear you've modified general relativity in some way. But here, in these quantum gravity pictures, you also have to do some modifications, because in order to get finite results, you have to create these framings. And the results that you get are dependent on the framings that you pick, right? So really, you've done something to change the theory. And the hope is that in the end of the day, you'll get the right theory of the universe by picking the right regularization scheme. So it's possible that these modifications are similar to, are natural. You want to pick natural modifications. And string theory seems to be a natural way to regularize quantum gravity, too. So it's possible that these two natural schemes happen to be connected at some level. And why would I ever have any reason to believe that there could be a connection and that it could have anything to do with framing? Well, Florian, who's sitting here, and I'm really glad that he's here, suggested a prescription for writing strings when you have frame spin networks. So the basic idea, and I don't want to talk about it too much because he understands it much better than me, but is that you have these frame spin networks and you can sort of insert strings into them, and that the string world sheets are dual to the frame spin networks. Which is really interesting. So he did it in the context of Yang-Mills theory, where you can actually find an isometry between the partition function of Yang-Mills theory and the string action. But what would be interesting is to try to do this for spin networks in quantum gravity, in which case you'd have an isometry between quantum gravity partition functions or the spin networks of quantum gravity and the world sheet action for string theory. But the strings that he finds are not quite the Nabokov string action. So that prescription is something that he came up with, but there might be other ways of doing it. Okay. But the strings you get are not quite the Nabokov string. They're similar, but different. And in fact, in certain limits, they are the Nabokov string. So the question is, you could ask yourself the question, how could we ever know whether or not these strings are the same as the normal strings from string theory or variations of? And so my claim is that, well, if we know that there's a connection between the 1 plus 1 CFT and the 2 plus 1 gravity, and then possibly there's a connection or an isometry between gravity and non-perturbative background-independent strings, then we can actually make a connection between these background-independent strings and the CFT. And then we can compare those results with the real results of string theory. Because in string theory, we have definite conjectures about what the CFTs for various strings should look like. So it's possible that we can make this more precise. But we need to have an ADS CFT for gravity. And we need to possibly refine Florian's, or use Florian's definition or others. Oh, we also need like supersymmetric models and stuff too. But yeah. So that is my wild statement. And that's what I'm going to end with. So thank you all for listening.
So seeing as we went a bit over time, maybe we can take one or three questions. Any questions?
Yeah.
So in 2001, there is at least 14 Nabokov string. I don't know for other string action. There is no critical string during 2001. However, there's a critical embedding in 2+2, which is ignored by the Spring community because you can't bring it to 3+1. But you could put that on a circle, which is like kind of the most trivial compact application, so it doesn't introduce much kinds of things. Then you could compare that directly.
So it would be interesting. There's a lot of work to be done.
I mean, I'm kind of worried that your string in 2+1 might be kind of
In string theory, you have all these extra dimensions too, right? And so ultimately, there's, I think, more work to be done to understand if you could actually have compact dimensions or something, or some internal symmetry dimension.
Well, it's just that the embedding in 2+1 might not actually work.
That's true. Yeah.
I mean, the string creature is quite different from the usual polyhedral string. So the criterion for criticality doesn't really apply there.
Oh.
You could also say, well, this string theory is just because it's different from string theory.
But does it have any kind of bonuses?
These spin forms or strings come from a dual transformation.
Okay.
So they're exactly, and in the case of the unknowns, they're exactly equivalent to the unknown theory. Mm-hmm. So you know this thing is finite and this works. Okay. But then it's very different when you look at the amplitudes, the way it's set up. It looks kind of stringy, but it's quite different from usual string theory.
But then
there's a
question, like in 2+1, do you get Lorentz formation?
No. You mean in violation of Lorentz invariants?
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, effectively, you want to have some background space time that will look like classical space time. And in that case, once you have some effective field theory that tells you what space quantum geometry is going to look like, then you have something that you can call the Lorentz invariants. And then you can make statements about whether or not there is a reason. But at the fundamental level, you still have these spin connections that are SO2-1 or SO3-1 connections. So you'd expect that's some analog Lorentz invariant microscopic. So my answer is yes, but tentatively.
Why would you ask the question?
Well, because string theory is only kind of really Lorentz invariant in the sense that the classical first chapter of the string theory book tells you that these strings transform only under the representation in the critical string theory. So basically, that anomaly which is behind that translates into, in some sense, Lorentz violation if you're not in the critical string theory.
But you don't
have critical string theory in 2+1.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean that.
If there's some dictionary strings in 2+1 and quantum gravity in 2+1, so I thought it's
possible. I think there's a lot of work to be done, which is why I've sort of stated these things in such a vague way. But I think the work to be done is interesting and might lead to some very interesting results. Of course, if you're successful in this program, then you have a really, really interesting result. There's a lot of work to be done before we get there. Yeah.
I mean, Laurent might know, but with the Lorentz invariance breaking in, is there an effective theory for 3D gravity?
Yeah, well, you can show that. What happens is that Poincaré symmetry is effectively deformed by the fact that you're dealing with quantum gravity. So there's an average flat space time. But of course, this flat space time fluctuates. And you can really compute the effect on that on FTP theory, and you can show that the FTP theory carries a representation of the Poincaré group.
Yeah.
but the way these projects act on, you know, multi-particle space is deformed compared to the naive action. So which is, you know, should be the case because this flat space time is only an average flat space time. And we expect that in general in any field of projects, that is, you're not going to have an exact flat space time.
Yeah.
In a one-on-one situation, there should be an average effect on that, on the effective symmetry.
Right. So lack of Lorentz invariance.
So it is Lorentz invariant, but, you know,
but it's a, yeah,
more
that's
convoluted.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
So maybe we should thank Sean again and stop.